people, you know, wake up and shake off the dust. There's something happening here, and you might not see it, but what you're experiencing in your personal life is real, and it's awful, and you're not alone in fighting it.
The flag was hoisted before the world.
What does it mean to fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidai.
I am a professor, which makes me a nerd. And the way that I understand life is through reading. Mm-hmm. And when I face something that I don't know how to deal with, I buy a book. A few months ago, I was at the Strand in Manhattan, and I came upon a book. We need to talk about anti-Semitism. And I immediately thought, yes, we do. And I just had to buy this book to understand better. And I think I read it within 3-4 days. Just couldn't stop reading it. And this is where things get interesting, because it's such a Jewish thing. I was sitting on my stoop like I do every night, kind of unwinding. My neighbor, Debbie, came up, and I was telling her about this amazing book that I was reading, and she said, oh, I'm meeting the person that wrote this book tomorrow. And that's how I got to know you. So here I am with Rabbi Diana Fresco from the Village Temple. Nice having you here.
It's such an honor to be here. And I can take a lot of lessons from your story, one of which is that all roads lead to Shabbat dinner. I met your friend, Deborah.
Is that where you met her, Shabbat dinner?
Absolutely. It was a friend of a friend. And she said, I'm reading your book. And then a few days later, I got a text from our friend and said, hey, Shai Davidai is also reading your book. Any chance he could text you? So I'm a rabbi, and that also makes me a nerd. So I very much appreciate your approach to life of, you know, learning through study and engagement with the written word, and I'm honored to be here with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here, and, you know, we already met once. We had coffee. You graciously were willing to have coffee with me, and, you know, one thing that's very interesting about being a secular Jew like myself, an atheist Jew that I've been open about it, is that people don't understand that a lot of times, even though we don't believe in anything, mm-hmm. or I don't believe in anything, we still need a rabbi. We still need that someone. We need the community. We need that someone. So thank you for being a rabbi in my life. I want to start with a question that I try to ask everyone. Mm-hmm. Rabbi, what kind of a Jew are you?
Wow. Okay, no one's asked me that before. So let me think about that. I'm a Jew who loves being Jewish and who loves Jewish people. Even the Jewish people I don't like, I love them. So I love being with Jews of all ages, little kids, teaching them the Shema, sitting with them on the floor for the first time. I love being with older Jews, listening to what their life is like, their happy times, their aches and pains, learning from them, their wisdom. And I like listening to Jews, and I like bringing them closer to Judaism, helping them do more Jewish things. Mm-hmm. That's what kind of Jew I am.
And how did you become this kind of Jew?
I don't know.
What? Let me ask you this. You know, obviously, many, many Jews are now speaking up. They are standing up or fighting back. You have written a book that helps us do that. It's almost like a blueprint in a way. Mm-hmm. How did you get to writing that book? And obviously, that book is a reflection of things that you are, that you're thinking. So walk me through that a little bit. Like, how did you become that person?
Sure. So it's two answers. One answer is how I became the person I am. And the other is the book. How did that end up happening? you know, how I became the person I am is a much longer story. But basically, I grew up in a very Jewishly committed family. We went to synagogue almost every week. I had a giant painting of an Israeli flag in my house. Uh-huh. I had my bat mitzvah on Masada.
Masada?
Yes.
Oh, nice. Yeah. My brother had his in Masada as well.
Yeah. I mean, that was like one of the things to do at that age. And I think that I loved Judaism. By the time I got to college, I had developed some better language skills and I could study more text in the original. And I realized, you know, Judaism was hard. And it resonated with me as a reflection of real life. There weren't a ton of easy answers, but there were amazing questions, profound stories, and an opportunity to gain actual wisdom, which I think is increasingly more difficult to grasp these days. So, you know, I was all in, mm-hmm. I would say, by the time I became an adult. But how the book happened is kind of a different thing.
But before we get to the book, actually, this is interesting because there's Judaism and then there's Jewishness.
Yeah.
And while we often talk about them together, but they're actually two different things that obviously correlate a lot in the world, and people that are very Jewish tend to also have a lot of Judaic roots and et cetera. But not everyone who is strongly devout into the Judaism is also very Jewish. And I feel like you're very Jewish.
Yes. If I could rebrand the thing, I might call it Jewishness.
Jewishness.
And Judaism is a part of it. You know, it's one way we express our Jewishness. How did I get to be like a Jewy Jew? Is kind of your question.
Yes.
A lot of that is because I'm a New Yorker. So in New York, I have this huge, amazing opportunity to be exposed to Jews that are like me and Jews that are not like me. And what I mean by that is I'm in relationship with Orthodox Jews. I'm in relationship with Persians, with Israelis. Obviously, I'm a Reform rabbi, so Reform Jews, conservative Jews, Jews who vote differently than I do, Jews who have different generational experiences than I do. And I think being exposed to the like diversity of Jewish experiences and expressions has had a huge impact on my ideas and my development and the way I look at the world. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in like a recipe for how to make Jews more Jewish, I think that's one important component of it. Like be with Jews like you, but also not like you.
Right. But then, so now we get to your book because you, and maybe you're writing another book, I don't know, but you didn't call your book, We Need to Talk About Jewishness, or We Need to Talk About Judaism, or We Need to Talk About Being a Jew. You called it, We Need to Talk About Anti-Semitism, right? It was, or it is, a call for action, right? It's calling out people, both Jews and non-Jews, here's what we need to do. So tell me a little bit about the book. How did you get to the book?
Sure. So I'm a congregational rabbi. It's the best job one could ever have. And as you know, I have this incredible privilege of getting to speak from the Bema every week about topics I feel are morally urgent. For me, anti-Semitism had long been one of those topics. So this is maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I started to talk about this. And at the beginning, I got some pushback. And it's important to talk about it now because it seems unthinkable. And the pushback was like, don't talk about anti-Semitism because it's over.
And that pushback was from Jews, from non-Jews?
Yeah, from Jews. And I don't judge them. They're incredibly smart people that were telling me this. And it resonated with me.
So when you say you don't judge them, why do you think people would say that? Like,
I felt it too to some extent. You know, if you grew up like I did, then it felt historical. Anti-Semitism was something we looked at. We went to a movie about it. We went to a museum and looked at an exhibit. We went to a survivor testimonial and heard them speak. But it was them, those older Jews. It was in the past.
So we were fine. Like Dara Horn's book, like people love dead Jews. It's something that happened. It's something that we are fascinated with in the past, but it's not, anti-Semitism is not a living creature.
Yes. And I understood that, you know, because as I said, I felt it too. But nonetheless, I really sort of still saw it happening. And, you know, the more you, I'm sure you know this, the more you talk about something, the more people talk about it to you.
Yes.
So I kept talking about anti-Semitism, and then people would come up to me and tell me their stories. And they would say things like, you know, there's an affinity group at my school, my kids' school, for every single minority group. And I asked for one for the Jewish students, and the administration told me, you know, now's not the time, or the optics don't look good.
Mm-hmm.
Or for me, a big rift in my world was the Women's March. That was such a moment in American culture and politics. And so many people in my community were activated and wanting to go to the Women's March. But then...
As they should, because it still is a very important cause.
Of course. Right. And then it turned out the leaders were saying these really hateful statements about Jews. And I started to hear these stories over and over and over again. And yet I saw nothing reflected about the rise of anti-Semitism in the liberal world in the public discourse. Almost nothing. Not a headline, not a think piece. You know, it was as if it wasn't happening.
Why do you think that's the case?
I think media professionals are better equipped to answer that question.
I know, but it looks like your immediate reaction. I don't want to put you on the spot, but it looks like you have a response, and you're like you're the rabbi speaking from the bima, and you don't want to say your gut. And it's okay if you don't want to, but also like no judgment. Like if there's,
I'm not sure.
Okay,
my guess would be, anti-Semitism works. It works well. So even if you're a good person, and even if you're a, quote, good liberal, whatever that means, you still might have some anti-Semitism in you. So if you think that Jews really do have outside influence, and if you think Jews really are, you know, privileged, wealthy, controlling maybe, then... you don't think we need any sort of help.
Mm-hmm.
And that's anti-Semitism at play.
Right. Yeah, there. That's very interesting. You know, and I chose to call this podcast a Jewish civil rights podcast, right? It's not just a Jewish podcast, a Jewish civil rights podcast. And you know, and one thing you just said now, which is really important, you said, even if you're a good, well-meaning liberal, then you still have anti-Semitism in you. I think one of the things that happened throughout the past decade, maybe a bit more in the United States, is an understanding that even if you're a good, well-meaning liberal, you still have implicit racism embedded in you because just as a function of living in a society that has racism. But people don't just accept that and say, okay, so we're all, you know, a little bit racist, like that Broadway musical, Avenue Q, and therefore, what are you going to do? They say, well, I have to fight it. I have to change it. Mm-hmm. Why is it the case that with everyone's a little bit anti-Semitic, you get this, like, shrug and like, well, whatever, you know?
Right. Well, first of all, I want to clarify, I actually don't go down that line of thinking of everyone is, you know, fill in the blank. I think you can be, and it does happen, and it's out there. I think what you're asking is at the core, like, why does anti-Semitism exist? You know, Jews are targets of a double standard. And for me, I love how you're framing this in terms of civil rights. It all goes back to the Rabbi Jonathan Sacks definition of anti-Semitism, where he says something along the lines of, anti-Semitism is not allowing Jews to exist collectively the way we allow others to exist collectively. Right? That's what anti-Semitism is, and that's what you're asking. Like,
right.
You know, how can this be happening? We see all of these other models apply to other groups, or we see other reactions to tragedies, you know, and yet for us, it seems the standards are different.
But I want to push back on that. And actually, that's something that when I was reading your book, I never really thought about that definition. And mm-hmm. I thought it was a very eye-opening definition. But I do want to push back, because if any other minority would say, no, it's not about for us living collectively. Mm-hmm. It's for me existing in the world. Mm-hmm. Like I, you know, if you're LGBTQ, it's like you not living in the closet. Mm-hmm. If you are an African-American in the United States, it's you being able to drive and not being worried about being pulled over because you are of a certain race, right? Why is the collectively so important? Like, why, like, you know, someone would say, no, like, anti-Semitism is you not, like, I'm not anti-Semitic because you as a Jew can exist here. It's mm-hmm. just the your desire for collectiveness is the problem. Why is that the thing that...
It's such a good question because...
Thank you. Yeah. Years of being a professor.
No, it's an amazing question. Jews are a people. And that's part of what is deeply annoying to others that really, really, really want to be anti-Semitic, whether they would call it that or not. We're ancient, right? We're an ancient people, and we don't fit into all of these molds and labels that we like to use. You know, we don't fit in completely. So it's not that we're a class. It's not that we're a race. It's not that we're a religion. It's not that we're a gender. You know, we're a people. It's much more like being a big family. So it very much matters what how we're talked about collectively, how mm-hmm. we're treated as a group, because at the end of the day, that's what we are. And for some reason, which I don't have the answer to, that really, really, really bothers the modern mind.
Right. The modern mind, and I would say it's not just the modern mind, right? But it really is a sticking point right now that in a world where we're all supposed to be individuals, mm-hmm. we're all supposed to celebrate our individuality, and seeing people like you and I mm-hmm. and many others that are, you know, outwardly very liberal, very individualistic, very, you know, with all my tattoos and everything, like, you know, we all have our different jewelry and we're all very individualistic, and yet we identify as a collective as well. And I think that is something people don't know how to deal with. It works against their idea of like individualism being the most important thing. So back to your book. So you mention in your book something interesting that when I read it, I was like, wait, I have to read this again. You said that when you were pitching the idea for a book, one editor said, great, it's an interesting idea, but why center on Jews? Right? You're writing a book about anti-Semitism, but don't center on Jews. You know, you can tell me a lot about that, but what I want to know is, what was your immediate reaction when someone tells you that? Was it slap them in the face? Was it shock? Was it a double take? What was it?
I mean, some frustration, but it's also some comedy. Like, you can't take that sort of comment seriously. You can only understand it as a reinforcement of what I call internet rules, right? Only the internet could come up with the rule that you can't censor Jews in a book about anti-Semitism. Yeah. And it's not just this editor. You know, I've been around the country with this book, and I'll give you an example. A teen in Chicago told me they did have a unit on the Holocaust in her high school, which, by the way, is increasingly uncommon.
Yeah, I recently learned mm-hmm. that only 20 states have mandatory Holocaust education, and 3 more have recommended. Mm-hmm. But the majority of states do not have any Holocaust education. So the fact that this teen had, you know, is already, right. It's weird to say that that's an achievement. And I'm not even talking about Jews. It's the biggest obviously one of the most important, if not the most important thing of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's also anti-Semitism at the core. But yeah.
Right. So she said they did have a unit on the Holocaust, but the unit did not focus on Jews. It wasn't about that.
So how do you teach about the Holocaust with no Jews?
Right.
It's like Garfield without Garfield. Right. You know that cartoon? It's like it's Odie and John. Like, what do you how do you teach about?
Right. So basically in her class, what she explained is they focused on the murder of other minority groups. So the murder of the Roma, the murder,
which is important. Like, we're not dismissing it. Like, it's extremely important.
It's horrific.
Jehovah Witnesses, the LGBTQ community, the black community. It was a small community in Germany, mm-hmm. but yeah.
That's what they focused on. And to me, that is an expression of low-level Holocaust denial to suggest in an academic setting that the Holocaust was not about the Jews is a way of beginning to teach Holocaust denial. Mm. So I think that there's this just eagerness to deny Jewish history, to divorce the Jewish people from who we are and our own history. And that's part of why I wrote the book I wrote, because I'm trying to say to people, you know, wake up and shake off the dust. There's something happening here. And you might not see it reflected in the national sort of discourse, but what you're experiencing in your personal life is real and it's awful, and you're not alone in fighting it.
Yeah. So, one second. There's something on the screen.
I saw that.
Yeah. That's good?
It's totally fine. Anytime that happens, we're just going to
yeah,
mask it out.
Yeah.
Just keep going. Thank you.
So it sounds like you wrote the book for fellow Jews,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like we the community need to start talking about anti-Semitism. Is that?
That's really where my heart is. You know, I'm someone who loves to be with the Jewish people. That's what I've dedicated my life to. So the book is very much applicable for everyone, and I've gotten amazing letters from Christians and people all over the country. But at its core, it's a way of saying to Jews, let me explain to you what's happening. You know that this is wrong in your core, but it's not really coming from the outside landscape the way it we would want it to. You know, it's not, your university is not going to explain to you what's happening to you.
So it's all, you could have titled it, Hey, You're Being Gaslit.
Yeah,
but okay. So you write a book about Jews for Jews, not exclusively for mm-hmm. Jews. And by the way, I actually think it's there are a few very important books in the past 10 years about anti-Semitism, and I think this is probably the most easily digestible one. And I'm not saying it as a diss. Like
I
think
it's
like very well organized, and it's like, and it doesn't go into the weeds so much as it goes into breadth,
mm-hmm.
right? But I want to contrast that with the books that are written about racism,
mm-hmm.
right? The most famous book is How to Be an Anti-Racist, mm-hmm. right? Or the book White Fragility.
Mm-hmm.
Those books are not focused, they're not written to and for people of color.
Mm-hmm.
They're written for white individuals that want to help, want to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
Why not, instead of we need to talk about anti-Semitism, is you need to talk about anti-Semitism. Like, what is the reluctance of non-Jewish Americans or in North America or anywhere else in the world of saying, hey, this is your problem. This is not our problem. This is a societal problem.
The problem that I'm trying to address in the book is lack of strong Jewish identity in the Jewish community. So that's why I wrote the book for Jews, because I see a lot of Jews confused, intimidated, and unclear about the anti-Semitism that they're facing. And this is pre-October 7th. You know, this book came out before then.
It came out on September 2023, right? So, like,
yeah.
It was... I don't want to be too biblical, you know, but it's a bit prophetic in a way. Like, people could tell a story of, like, Rabbi Diana Fersko knew.
Listen, I think it's... People say to me, you need to update the book now, right? And the sad, sad truth, Shai, is that I don't, because it's all there.
Mm.
What's happening... I have a whole chapter called The Way We Talk About Israel. it had all happened before in different ways, in different scales. And so all of these sort of anti-Semitic tropes that are being rolled out, they're set pieces. You know, they had happened before. The fall of the universities, that's happened before. The, singling out of the Jewish people, blood libelous language. Like, these are all things that have happened in our past and in our history. And if you knew them before, you were horrified but not surprised by the reaction to the October 7th massacre. I feel like I got a little bit away from your question.
No. This is exactly what I want. I want us to have this conversation, because there's so many things, and obviously I can talk about this for hours, but if it's... Let me start again. You're absolutely right, right? It's all been done before. Nothing's new under the sun. Mm-hmm. Yet at the same time, there's so many Jewish people walking around the world right now feeling like this is different.
Mm-hmm.
This is bigger. This is scarier. Are we overreacting? Are we just unaware of our history? Or is there something different now?
We're not overreacting. We might be underreacting. And
explain that. I'm sorry, but...
Sure.
You can't drop it. We might be underreacting without explaining that.
I don't know what we're in. None of us do. We need to approach this with a lot of humility. Are we at the beginning of something? Are we at a peak of something? I don't know. So it's incumbent upon us to take a step back and say, how bad could this be? And also, maybe I've done everything I could to fight. I don't know. I just don't know. But I think the Jewish people need to be pretty serious when we're analyzing the trends that are happening in our country right now.
Yeesh. So, okay, so going back to the question of, is there something unique in this specific moment? And I can tell you from my own life, like, up until October 6th, I'm still just a guy, but like, none of my friends would have even imagined, including myself, by the way, that I would be walking around with the biggest Star of David that I could find in the world, right? No one in their right mind would say on October 6th, hey, Shai, you know, within a year, you'll have a podcast about Jewish civil rights.
Right.
Like, we'd be like, what the, you know, like, no way.
Uh-huh.
So clearly something is different, or maybe just different in my personal life.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like something is different now?
Okay. What's happening now is familiar in terms of Jewish history, right? It's not different. It's familiar. That's what scares me about it. What's happening on a personal level for us is profoundly different. And I've seen a huge shift in what it means to be a Jewish American. And I've started calling it an American Jew, by the way, these days. People are reassessing the media they consume, the way they vote, the schools they send their children to, how they see themselves, what they think it means to be a Jew. These are seismic shifts in the Jewish American experience. And I'll just use my book as an example. Before October 7th, a journalist joked with me, you know, lovingly, like, oh, you should have called your book, We Need to Talk About Anti-Semitism Less. Right? Because the idea then was like, oh my gosh, get over it. Like, this is nothing.
Really?
This is not a big deal. And that was the prevailing attitude. So of course, what's happened since October 7th, the sort of embrace of anti-Semitism, I'll say, by different institutions and leaders, has been hugely painful and shocking to the American Jewish community. And I think Jews are out there really activated and trying to fight back.
Is it an embrace, or is it always been embraced and now it's just embraced in the open?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
So one of like the theories.
You're such a Jew.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Guilty. Yeah. I am. One of the theories about anti-Semitism is like, you know, well, like a question about anti-Semitism is, how does it work? Like, why does it work across geographies, across history, throughout time, with different classes, with different groups? Like, it seems to permeate every single boundary that we like to think about as a boundary. And one of the answers is that people keep coming back to it because it works to activate a base. So that might be one of the answers to your questions. Like, was it always there? Well, yes. And I think these organizations that wrote horrible letters on October 8th, you know, they didn't appear on October 8th. They've existed for a long time, and they've been funded and organized. So, yes, it was there. But anti-Semitism at its core is a popular youth movement. It's popular. That's the thing. It feels right to be anti-Semitic for lots of people.
It's like a virtuous form of bigotry.
Yeah. It feels like justice. And I like to use the example of the Crusaders to explain this because it's far enough away that it doesn't feel political to people.
You might, I don't know, the internet might be rolling.
Right.
Be careful what you say. You'll be like, you'll be canceled for talking about the Crusades.
Right. But, luckily, yeah. I have no internet presence, so okay. I'm good. But the idea with the Crusades is that they were spreading Christianity across Europe, right? The truth, the religious way, the just way, the correct way. That was the idea. Not that we're anti-Semites and we're going to kill tens of thousands of Jews, you know, on our quest. It was virtuous. That's how anti-Semitism often feels, like the right thing to do. And we, the Jews, are in the minority, the outside, on the other side of that popular feeling.
Yeah, it's interesting about the Crusades is that the goal was not the Jews, right? This is something that people maybe misconstrue about the history. Like, the Crusades were about, quote-unquote, liberating Jerusalem from Muslim rule at the time. But on the way from Western Europe to Jerusalem, they passed through Eastern Europe, and lo and behold, oh, there's a lot of Jews here. We might as well kill them, rape them, you know, torture them.
So let me interrupt you then and ask you this. Do you think this is about the Jews?
This right now?
Yeah.
I think the world needs the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So they have something to hate.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is about a basic lack of communal identity.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are seeing is people defining them as opposed to us,
mm-hmm.
right? That is why you have, I'm a Zionist,
mm-hmm.
someone on the other side of the, you know, the illegal encampment,
mm-hmm.
doesn't have a word for themselves. They are an anti-Zionist.
Right.
If I stop existing, mm-hmm. they don't have a reason to exist anymore.
Uh-huh.
I think they say it's about Israel, but really is, and going back to your book, it's about the idea that we, as Jews, are a community.
Mm-hmm.
The weird thing is, when I started speaking up, my mom asked me, what's your goal?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, to end anti-Semitism. And she was like, you're not going to do that.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, not with that attitude.
Right.
But I think I've realized that no, that is not my goal, mm-hmm. because I'm not going to end anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. But I want to make it so uncool mm-hmm. and so mm-hmm. shameful that people stop needing anti-Semitism to yeah. get along.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I do want to talk, because there's something that that I want to ask you about from your book. And I'm going to skip a little bit, but it says, you say this, if you're Jewish and want to fight anti-Semitism, do something Jewish, anything. When people bring shame, respond with pride. When people spread lies, respond with facts. When people casually dissuade us from embracing our Jewish identity, respond with Jewish practice. Try more learning, more community, more religion. Try having more Jewish experiences. If we want anti-Semitism to wane, we must stand up and be counted as Jews. It's so extremely beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I have a problem with that. As someone who does not believe in God, mm-hmm. is not religious, and yet very, very Jewish, what can I do? How do I find myself in this kind of response to anti-Semitism?
Everything you're doing falls into that exact category.
Well, not me, Shai Davidai, but me, like, I assume I hope there's other people like me, or, you know, I'm not special.
Speaking up about being Jewish is a very Jewish thing. So when I say that, of course, I'm talking about, you know, ritual acts, like lighting Shabbat candles and celebrating holidays and that sort of thing. But I'm also talking about very simple acts that any Jew can do regardless of belief and embrace of religiosity. So do your coworkers know you're Jewish? That's a real...
Now they do.
Right. You, we know. You're done. but for a lot of Jewish Americans, they fly under the radar. Maybe they'll wear a kippah at a synagogue once in a while, but they'll never wear one at work. Maybe there's an opportunity to say, I actually can't go to this event on Friday night because I have a family dinner. We call it Shabbat dinner. Simply letting people know you're Jewish and taking up space at this point is an act of Jewish solidarity. So I really urge people to pick one thing and do it. It's not overwhelming to just try one thing.
So why do people need to be urged to do so? Why aren't we doing it already? And I can tell you, I met a professor, I won't out her, obviously, who has a non-Jewish last name, mm-hmm. meaning no one can recognize. Mm-hmm. And no one, she's a tenured professor, no one knows that she's Jewish. And she is the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, my imperative is to survive mm-hmm. by any means necessary, mm-hmm. which is taking the opposite of what these pro-Hamas protesters are doing by any means necessary. And she's saying, no, survival for me by any means necessary, meaning not publicly let people know that I'm Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't we already doing what you're saying? Why aren't we already being Jewish in public, fighting anti-Semitism just by our existence?
I'm going to answer your question with a story. When my in-laws were looking for a synagogue for their children, one is now my husband, the rabbi said to them, you know, if we make them, your kids, good people, we've done our job. That was the thinking for a Jewish American for a long time.
So like tikkun olam.
Assimilate and be a good person.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means to be a Jewish American. Make the world better. Give tzedakah. Do tikkun olam. Volunteer. You know, be civically engaged. That happened over generations. You know, that happened for many decades, that way of thinking, where we were told what's good is to mostly be like everyone else. I don't believe that that's the case anymore. I think we need to be much more like who we are and what we are, which is Jews. Mm-hmm. And even if we ourselves don't want that at times, society is now telling us, whether you like it or not, this is how we see you. And I say, great, I'd love nothing more than to be a Jew. I want everyone to know about it. I want every Jew to be engaged in it. Judaism is the greatest gift that humankind has ever received. Why would I not want more Jews to be engaged?
I would say Netflix is a close second.
A close second.
But no. So, but then people are scared. What do you tell them? Like, I'm sold. I want to speak up. I want to act. And by the way, I tell that to people. Like, sometimes just wearing a Star of David and keeping your mouth shut is speaking up.
Absolutely.
Like, on the subway, wearing a Star of David is showing the world and showing other Jews that we are here. But what if people are afraid? What if people are scared?
First of all, I think a lot of Jews are doing exactly what we're talking about right now. You know, they're writing letters, they're advocating for their children, they're letting their workplaces know, actually, this policy is kind of like not working for us. So I think a lot are. If you're scared, I always say, one, lead with vulnerability. You know, you don't have to go like charge, rush the gates. You can say, I'm a little uncomfortable to say this, but, or I want to try this new ritual at home, but I don't know where to begin, and ask someone. Like, it is fine to lead with vulnerability. And the second thing is pick your spot. You know, you don't need to throw yourself into the hardest place. Like, you can start this practice of engaging with Judaism more, however that looks for you, in the smallest of ways. So find something that feels okay, uncomfortable for you, and do that.
So I even say something like, go to a march for the hostages, blend in the crowd. And I tell people, like, I go, obviously the most important thing for me is in keeping awareness about the hostages, like at the top of mind for everyone.
Yes.
But I also go for the community. I go because there's 1 hour every week where I belong. What about non-Jews? Like, clearly we cannot win this fight alone. And by the way, I don't think any minority can win any fight alone. And throughout history, different minorities worked with each other to help elevate each other and fight for civil rights. What can non-Jews who want to help us in the fight for Jewish civil rights do?
So clearly,
we're not going to do Shabbat. Right. And, like, they can and they're welcome, but that's not what we expect them to do, right?
Well, right. That's not what I you know, not proselytizing. That's not what I expect them to do. But I will say,
you're not allowed to proselytize.
Right. After. And I don't want to. After October 7th, we actually did have a lot of non-Jews coming to our synagogue, our services. And one sort of example, and I mean this with respect, is in the middle of the service, a visitor stood up and said, "This is the best mass I've ever been to." And I thought, okay, something's happening here. Like, this is new. This is new. So I think that we know the majority of the country is with us. It doesn't always feel that way in the pockets and that you and I live in, but I've received letters from non-Jews. I've received visits. I've received donations. That sort of stuff matters because it reminds us there are just basic good people in our country that are aware that something really strange and unsavory is happening towards the Jewish people. And they're not okay with it. So for others, I say, look for your local Jewish community and say, is there anything I can do? How can I help?
So let's talk about your congregation for a little bit. You lead probably one of the most progressive congregations in New York City, maybe even in the United States. In the smack center of the village, you obviously have values that are aligned with supposedly the values of organizations that we expected to have our backs. from your book, it's clear that you weren't surprised when they didn't have her back. Mm-hmm. But were you disheartened?
Well, a few things. One, I actually wouldn't describe my congregation in any kind of political way.
No, progress. You know? I was more in values rather than in politics.
In terms
politics, I could do without. It's more about the values.
Yeah. I was very disheartened, would be the answer. So I think that people that live in very liberal neighborhoods and work in very liberal spaces have been some of the hardest hit by this spike in anti-Semitism. So my congregation has been, during 2020, during the Black Lives Matter protests, was attacked with a baseball bat. That was a major impetus for me to write the book because it's horrifying. Why is my synagogue attacked with a baseball bat?
So someone just walking down the street sees a synagogue and starts smashing windows?
It's not clear to me. If they thought, there was a lot of destruction at that time in our neighborhood.
Yeah,
so.
But I don't remember any churches, mosques, Buddhist temples, Hindu temples. Like, I don't remember anything else.
I just, it's horrific to see your house of worship attacked. Then.
Or your house, period.
Or your house.
Yeah.
Then I was actually, this is also pre-October 7th, returning from a meeting with the ADL, of all places. And I'm walking back, whatever, and what do I see? A dollar sign spray painted on the front of my synagogue. Mm-hmm. So these are things that were already happening, to your earlier point, in our neighborhood and in our community. Then when October 7th happened, it really loosened anti-Semitism and almost formalized it. So it became more popular to be anti-Israel. But of course, what happens here is that when we talk about Israel, it has no effect on Israel, right? Kids in Tel Aviv are not thinking, I wonder what a teenager in downtown is thinking about me. It affects us, the Jewish community here. So all of that anti-Israel, vitriol has nothing to do with Israel. But it's everything to do with us in terms of its outcome, where it releases itself and expresses itself. So that means people in my community have had great challenges in their workplace, horrific expressions of anti-Semitism in their children's schools. It means that frequently when you walk home from work, you walk by a rally chanting for the death of the Jewish people. It means that you see signs on public universities that say globalize the Intifada. It means your kids sleep in an apartment with an encampment underneath where they chant, kill the Jews. And you have to explain that to an 8-year-old child. So it's been very intense over these past many months. I certainly don't have to tell you what it's like. But I think your question was, am I disheartened? Yeah. It was very disheartening.
And then but then you have a unique situation that I think not many rabbis do, which is you tend to also interact a lot with Jews who may define themselves as anti-Zionists. Or I remember when we had coffee the other day, you said that the thing that people whisper now, in the halls is, did you hear that so-and-so kid is in an encampment, right? Tell me a little bit about that. How should we be thinking, if at all, about the Jewish people, mostly young Jewish people, but some of older Jewish people, that are aligning themselves with Hamas, with Iran. Now, obviously, they won't say that out loud, but in terms of their actions, in terms of the propaganda they push, in terms of the goals of the destruction of the State of Israel, how do we deal with those kind of Jews?
So, right, basically, everywhere I go to talk about my book, I have, someone asks the question you're asking, which is,
by the way, I'm asking this because I get asked that question and I need an answer.
I'll give you my answer. I mean, somebody always says, my child doesn't feel the same way about Israel that I feel. What do I do? And they ask it with tears in their eyes because it's personally painful. It feels like a rejection of the parent and their values.
Family, the tribe.
And the tribe. And I say a few things. One, prioritize shalom bayit, peace in the home. That, the family, is the core value of being Jewish, right? That's our unit. All you need to do is look at what Bereishit is filled with, and you will see, oh, this is a people that cares about the family first, in an almost like an obsessive way.
Yeah, who so, beget who beget who, this is the son of this. Yeah, exactly.
So don't destroy your family over this. Don't do it. Second, play the long game. People are, Jews, are always in and out of Judaism, right? You are an example. You never thought you'd be wearing a Magen David.
I'm unique in the sense that I've never been religious. I've never had a belief. Mm-hmm. And yet I've always been strongly Jewish. Mm-hmm. I'm a rabbi's worst dream, but I'm also like a non-Jew's worst dream, because I'm devout to both things. I'm equal parts Jewish and atheist. Yes. You know,
I love that. You're not my worst nightmare. Don't worry. I think that. So secondly, people are always in and out of Judaism in their own way. You know, you don't know. I didn't know I was going to be a rabbi. You don't know if you're going to keep kosher in the future. You don't know if you're going to make aliyah. You don't know if you're going to be secular. You don't know if you're going to become Haredi. Like, this happens all the time. People are engaging with Judaism. It's not linear, the way we engage with Judaism. So parents need to take a breath, have a pause, and maybe don't lay into this topic right now, when your kid has just, say, subsumed, I don't know, 50 hours of TikTok every, you know, every week at a minimum. But at the same time, reinforce your values. Do you? You know? So if you care about Israel, you have to show that. And if you have little kids and you care about Israel, you have to tell them that. And you have to tell them why. And you have to take them there. You can't assume that they're going to love Israel or feel about Israel the same way that you do. And then the last thing is something I mentioned before, which is be vulnerable with your child.
Hmm.
Tell them, this is really hard for me. I want to talk about this with you, but I don't know if you'll be open to it. Or I'm worried this will affect our relationship. I want to share this, but I'm not sure if, you know, it's a good idea to even bring it up. Like, I think that sort of approach will bear the best fruits for Jewish families rather than the sort of gut emotional reaction, which I understand, which is like, you know, I'm horrified and I'm outraged. But we really need to take a breath, step back and say, Jewish families are strong. We can get through this. Here's how.
Right. And I think that's a beautiful answer. And I think that's, I can see in your eyes why you're a rabbi. But also, you know, I'm asking now as not as a parent, you know, luckily my kids are 8 and 3 and I have no concern about them turning against Israel ever. But as us in the world, we're fighting for Jewish civil rights. We are trying to keep anti-Semitism in bay. We're trying to create institutions that protect Jewish liberties and equality. And yet the other side seems to tokenize these anti-Zionist Jews, and they are a very, very small minority in our group and in their group. And they are a tiny minority, but they use them to detract us from our fight. They're saying, you don't deserve civil rights because we found a few Jews that agree with us. How do we deal with that? I'm all for Shalom Bayit, for keeping the family, you know, together first and foremost. And yet, we have people amongst us from our tribe that are really stopping us from advancing.
Right. So I'm going to give an answer that's going to frustrate a lot of people. But yes, that's fine. Those Jews actually don't bother me. Like, they don't bother me at all. As you said, they're a very small fringe
wait,
group.
Wait, wait, wait. I, when you see in an encampment a Jew with a watermelon yarmulke who changed the last sentence of the Haggadah to next year, instead of next year in Jerusalem, next year in Liberty, or even next year in Palestine, does that not bother you?
I don't agree with it at all. I fiercely disagree with it. You know that.
If we turn off the mics, you'd say it bothers you? Or
no,
it really doesn't bother you?
No, and I'm going to explain why it doesn't bother me.
I love that. Okay.
In every instance where there is an existential threat to the Jewish people, there are Jews that are a part of it. It's just part of who we are. So I'll use, again, I like to go back in history so people don't can hear it better. Think about Christianity as a prototype. Who started that? Us, right? And it's happened every single time. Look at communism. That's a great example where Jews clung fiercely to communist ideas and were very aggressive in working against the mainstream, the core of the Jewish people. You know, people call that group sort of names, non-Jews, un-Jews. There are all kinds of names for those groups. They're Jews. I completely disagree with them. But I don't feel they're a threat to the future of the Jewish people.
So we just avoid them and we keep our course?
What does bother me is what you're talking about, the tokenization. That bothers me to no end. Holding up that sort of person and saying this represents the Jewish voice is just a lie.
Yeah.
It's just a blatant lie. The Reform Movement, which I'm a part of, the largest movement in the United States, is a Zionist movement, right? The Conservative Movement, the Orthodox Movement, we're Zionists. Every major Jewish organization, every attempt to organize Jews in any kind of broad national way has a Zionist component to it. So I don't appreciate the sort of just tokenizing is the only word for it. The lifting up of really a minority of in a minority of voices and pretending like that group speaks for us, that bothers me. And the reason it bothers me the most is not about the American public, it's about the Jewish community. Because I think that sort of tactic diminishes Jewish confidence and almost sort of suggests to us like, maybe that is what we think.
That's their goal.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
and
part
that's
of the tokenizing goal. It reminds me of a joke where a guy comes to the rabbi, his rabbi, and says, "Rabbi, I don't know what to do about my kid. They dropped out of school. They grew their hair long. They say they're no longer Jewish. We're walking around saying they're Christian." And the rabbi says, "I don't know. Like, my son also, like, grew their hair out, said they're no longer Jewish, and walk around saying they're Christian. Let's pray." So they pray, and finally God responds, and they say, "God, what do we do? You know, our kids grew their hair long. They're saying they're no longer Jewish and walking around saying they're Christian." And God says, "How the hell should I know? My son did the exact same thing." it is part of our history. It is part of who we are. And yet, it's painful. It's painful for me because we are a tribe. We are a family. And sometimes the things that strangers say won't hurt me at the very nothing. But if my brother or sister or parents would say that, it would kill me.
Sure, a family member.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
And Jews are family. You know, so I see, like, even if I don't know you and I see you, you're a Jew and you are using your Jewishness to undercut us, undercut, and not us, but undercut the goal of Jewish civil rights, of just protecting all of us. Not just you, because you were accepted in the encampment, but also me, who I don't want to give up my Zionism to be accepted. And I feel like that is putting me in jeopardy. And again, I don't blame Jews that are part of this anti-Zionist movement. I don't hate them. I am bothered by them. Mm-hmm. But I am... It's so confusing. I think that's the word, that mm-hmm. we're all trying to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you said Jews are a family. I agree, but I'm going to add, Jews are a stiff-necked people, right? That's what we're called in Torah over and over again.
What does
again.
That mean?
Stubborn.
Okay.
You have to accept the breadth of what it means to be a Jew. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I completely disagree with them. I 100% support your advocacy, and it's what's happening in academia is abhorrent. But do they bother me? You know,
yeah.
No, because I am a faith-based person, and I'm deeply confident in the future of the Jewish people, deeply. And that's different than saying, but what's happening on academia,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and when I get down, I remind myself of the quote from that Theodor Herzl wrote in The Jewish State. He says, throughout history, branches of Judaism or the Jewish world have withered and died, but the trunk remains robust.
That's right.
Right, mm-hmm. And I see them as a branch. So what does the future hold for the Jewish people? And what does it hold for Israel?
I have no idea about what does it hold for Israel. You know, I think there's a whole industry that try to answer that yeah. question. I'm more like, what is my job as a Jew? Not as a rabbi, as a Jew. I think my job is to do anything I can to strengthen the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
We're not about living for the future, right? Or the afterlife. We're about the present, here and now. Mm. So, name of your podcast, right? Here
yes.
I am, not tomorrow I will be. So, I think that's our job as a Jew. Focus. What can we do now to support Israel? What can we do now to strengthen the Jewish community in America? And that will lead to a better future.
I like that. But you're now... willing to make any predictions.
Like with what? The war?
No. With what's happening here. Will this, is this a wave that will calm and kind of will pass through this tsunami? Or is this a watershed moment in Jewish life in at least the United States, if not the whole diaspora?
My prediction is so much darker that I almost don't want to say it, which is what
we'll
I,
edit it out yeah, and we'll add some rainbows and
right,
sprinkles.
Take it out and post. You know. I could be wrong, very much so. I don't know. You know, none of us do. What I think will happen is that this spike will ease, okay? It will diminish. And it will diminish enough that we'll be lulled back into the happy place. Of thinking we're just like everyone else.
Not if I have anything to do with it.
You know, this is gone. This was because of October 7th. This was because of the war. This is because maybe people think it's because of, you know, Israel's actions in Gaza.
Which, by the way, I have to say, like, that when people say that, uh-huh. that drives me nuts. Because mm. that's the ultimate victim blaming.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what did she wear? Was she drinking? How did she act? We're just doing that for a state, but yeah.
I think it will diminish, and I think it will diminish enough for anti-Semitism to continue to foment and formalize itself as policy in more and more mm-hmm. sectors of American life. Now, the one thing I want to say about that is that I very much believe in America, and I love America, and I do think we will find our way out of this, but I think there could be a lot of pain in the future mm. as we do that.
Yeah, no, that's true. And my goal is not to find a way out of this, mm-hmm. but to find a way to defeat this and make the country and the world better. So even if another wave comes, mm-hmm. it will be weaker and we'll have the institutions in place. So where can people find you? You're not on social media, but...
Sure. I have a website. I'm pretty sure it's rabbidianafirsco.com. I have a newsletter. They can sign up there. Okay. And I don't have social media because I don't like it.
Okay. And if they want to come and see you at your congregation?
Come and see me. Village Temple, downtown Manhattan.
All right. Okay. So one thing that that I try to do.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I have it. This is so... It's not here. Let me bring it for a second.
By the way, don't worry. First of all, you guys are doing amazing. Yeah. I'm like really interested in this. And a lot of podcasts, I fall asleep. So thank you. I guess one thing we didn't discuss is when to wrap up. So I don't want you to feel pressure if I give you the hand.
Yeah.
But I know you had some follow-up questions.
Yeah.
Like rapid fire questions.
Yeah.
Sorry, I ruined your flow. Keep going.
Yeah. So obviously, this is kind of a silly question because I will recommend your book, We Need to Talk About Anti-Semitism, for anyone who's interested, Jew or non-Jew. What book or movie play would you recommend for people who want to educate themselves more about the Jewish people, about Israel, about anti-Semitism, about our fights, whatever it is?
I'm terribly sorry to give an answer that's so on brand.
But
my real answer is the Torah.
We talked about that.
You told me not to give that answer, but Shai, you have to realize all the answers are in there.
You know what? Okay, but you have to choose a book from the Torah because it's like, you know, there's many books in the Torah.
Okay.
Or a story.
A story. I like the Jacob stories, because he's a wrestler, right? He struggled.
He wrestled an angel. Mm-hmm.
An angel. He wrestled his own demons. He had many challenges, and he prevailed. So I would say read the Jacob stories, because they'll teach you a lot about yourself and a lot about life.
And if I'm not mistaken, when the angel calls him, he says, "Here I am."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we're gonna wrap up with what I'm trying to do as a Jewish lightning round.
Okay.
You know, you feel free to close your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You can say pass. I might not give you a pass, but come with the first answer if it comes to mind. What is one thing people don't know about you?
My initial answer was that I'm Jewish. Because I
walk
down the street.
Everybody knows about you.
No, I walk down the street all the time, and the guys from Chabad, they never ask me to shake the lulav. They never ask me to, you know, do I want candlesticks? Nothing. That's the thing I wish everyone knew. Now they know.
Love that. Rabbi Diana Firsco, people need to know that you're a Jew. What is one thing that people don't know about the Jews?
Oh, gosh. Maybe that we're the most interesting people in the world, and
right.
I can't get enough of us.
I follow up. What's one thing that's interesting about us?
Nothing's boring. You don't have to make up your mind. You can think.
You're not allowed to make up your mind, because if you will, someone will argue with you.
You're never going to resolve a debate, and you just move on, and that's just how it is. You know, it's like, what could be better?
That's the Talmud. Yeah. What is your favorite curse?
My favorite curse?
Yeah.
Pass.
Because you're a rabbi, I'll let you
fly with that
one. When was the last time you cried?
Oh. Well, when my daughter became bat mitzvah.
And that was last week.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
What was her parasha?
Not so.
Mm-hmm. If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Wow. Okay. Maybe Rebecca from Torah, because she has two parts of the Jewish being that I love. One, she's like physically strong. Remember the scene at the well, and she's maybe going to meet her betrothed eventually. She waters all the camels. Like, do you know how heavy that must have been? So she has like physical strength, which I think of as kind of Israeli, you know, mm-hmm. the ability to physically defend yourself. But also, she's incredibly clever, right? She orchestrates the entire narrative with her family to make her husband give the blessing to the correct child, and she's sort of the activist behind it all. So I think...
I've never heard of this as clever. I've always thought of it as conniving.
Well, that's a little judgy.
No, I'm not. I'm saying, you know, yeah. She has...
She's smart. She knew. Like, it should obviously be Jacob. Come on. I like that she holds like those two poles, body and mind. And I think that's what it means to be a strong Jew. So I want her to come over for Shabbat and tell me how she did it.
I love it. What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Passover.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Purim. Done. Easy.
When do you feel safest?
With my family.
When do you feel least safe?
Being the center of attention in ways I don't like.
You stand every week on the Bima, uh-huh. And you are the center of attention. So what are the kinds of not liking being a center of attention?
Shallow things, political things. Mm-hmm. Things that don't speak to me.
What gives you hope?
I have so much hope. That's like a very hard question for me. What gives me hope is the future of the Jewish people.
You remember you just said that it's going to get really, really dark. That gives you hope.
That's the short game. We're in it for the long game.
The long
right?
game
we're
gives
the,
you hope.
We're the eternal people.
Nice. Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Mm-hmm. Where would you want people to donate this week?
That feels like a lot of responsibility. I love an organization called IsraAid. They do amazing work in Israel, but also all over the world. And I've traveled with them. I worked on the Syrian refugee crisis with them. We did some work in Greece, and they were incredible. So I would say IsraAid.
IsraAid. Mm-hmm. So ISRA.
IAID.
Okay. Yeah. IsraAid. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. So here I am with Rabbi Diana Frisco.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality. And to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."